vice president never had any social affairs at the residence. You remember on the day that he left, we brought all the staff out to the guest house where he had a very warm visit with them, because it was impossible to squeeze it in otherwise. Well, it would have been possible on that Sunday, but as you say, he wanted that to rest, essentially. And the welcoming banquet, what is your memory of that?
Oh, it was quite warm with the band, a huge reception, band in the background, and Deng Xiaoping was there, as I recall, as the host, and quite a gathering of other vice premiers. That was in the huge banquet. His return banquet was in a different room, as I recall. But it was a huge affair. And then he gave his toast up on a platform.
Oh, that,
you remember
that was
that
the
room?
regular
room,
ballroom.
The ballroom. Regular, it was in the ballroom. Now,
regular banquet room.
His return banquet was not in that.
Which can seat 5,000 people.
That's right.
Right.
We can get that out of the file, but I think there were three or four vice premiers who were there. I think Fang Yi was there. Possibly Kang Shuen, although I'm not certain of that. But a number who had been to the United States,
right,
whom he had greeted. Yu Cho Li, perhaps, Li Chan, was quite a gathering.
Right.
And the thing just got off to a very rapid, warm start.
Now, the dinner, the banquet the previous night, of the first night of arrival of the Summer Palace, that was smaller and informal.
Very informal. This was the...
Hosted by Huang Hua.
By Huang Hua. This was the Chinese answer to Dr. Brzezinski's command dinner for Deng Xiaoping. I felt that they were bound to... I was thinking about it, the vice president did not wish to go, but I said that they're sticking you in return for the Brzezinski dinner.
You're probably right.
But it was a very gay, small affair. He could only, the same thing, there were limited numbers, so not everyone in his party could go, and I think he could only take 7 or 8, as Brzezinski had done. I mean, it really was the same thing back. They said you can only name 7 or 8.
Of course, it was in the same room where Deng Xiaoping had had the dinner for Vance in August of the previous year.
That's right.
2 years previous, 77.
That's right.
And I guess the biggest room in that building, but still small.
That's right. That's right.
And
now,
I think it was when did we have the big hullabaloo about the flags? That was on the Sunday, wasn't
that
it?
That was on the Sunday. That's correct. Because the visiting, Malagasy Republic
was
president was there, or premier.
Right. As a head of state, he got all these things. And there were also banners up greeting him, but no banners up greeting the vice president. I was told to talk to the Chinese about it, which I did with some reluctance because they were just following normal protocol. But as we went down, as I remember it, on the Monday morning to the Great Hall for the Vice President to meet with Deng Xiaoping, all the banners had gone. And I remember Vice President saying, "You see how efficient Leonard is." The fact is that the head of state had left Peking earlier that morning. And so they were very efficient at that. The minute he crosses the line, down come the decorations.
You recall, I was one who thought that those banners should come down. I was worried, I think Dick Holbrook too, that the story in the Washington Post would be underneath the lead sentence would be underneath banners for the president of the Malagasian Republic, Vice President Mondale arrived in China today.
No, that of course didn't happen. But that's that session that he had with Deng Xiaoping, I thought was it was very, very straightforward, very forthcoming, and I thought the vice president did an excellent job, because the by this time the Chinese were beginning to get a little uneasy about the development of the relationship, and he had just the right tone and the right approach.
That's right. He came with a good list of goodies to give, and he had identified them very much on his own, and he had gone to great effort, as I said earlier, in putting the package together. You may recall what it was: commitment to move on MFN, push the trade bill as soon as the Congress got back in session in October, November. Secondly, after its summer recess,
right.
He had an explanation for why it had not been sent up earlier. Secondly, an Ex-Im Bank commitment of $2 billion. Third, a very strong statement that we would treat China differentially from the Soviet Union on export controls, and that presaged a general view of China that was significant. And then treatment of China as a friendly country for purposes of reimbursable assistance projects. He was the negotiator
and OPIC,
in
which
that's right.
The Chinese at that point had apparently absolutely no interest. I don't think they understood what it was all about.
The interesting thing, which I'm sure you now know, is that Mondale himself put that package together. For example, Secretary Vance did not wish to extend, to designate, that's a Secretary of State's decision, and he did not wish to designate China as a friendly country, not under the domination of international communism, as the act required him to do. And Fritz Mondale personally, as the vice president, went to the State Department and went to Secretary Vance's office and asked him to sign that. And as Mondale told me later, he said that Tsai's reaction was, "All right, Fritz, I'll hold my nose and sign it." Exact wording that I recall. He also went up to the Hill as vice president again and called on Senator Byrd and extracted the promise from Senator Byrd, which was not difficult to extract because Byrd was committed to it, to could take the most favored trade bill, same with O'Neill, so he had done that. He really, very, very much to his credit, the way he
yes.
put that together.
And it came at just the right time and was of tremendous importance in renewing the momentum which had been seriously slowing down. And of course the...
You might want to say why it was had been slowing down. What were the main factors that you think slowed it down?
Well, the chief, I think it mostly centered on the trade agreement, the fact that it was so slow, and we kept promising the signing dates, and they kept slipping. And then finally that was done on the 7th of July. And at that time, we expected quick action on MFN. Other things had moved so very fast up until that point. So the Chinese were, I think, getting more apprehensive than unhappy.
Would you want to relate it to the sense that it was related to SALT, that what they sensed was not just the delay, but that the administration was appearing to be timid in establishing a difference between them and the Soviet Union?
Yeah, I remember now more than one informal conversation when I kept assuring them that that was not involved, that there were no tie-ups, that this was just the way sometimes our system worked.
Well, it was in that respect that I think Senator Jackson's trip, though, was not helpful to the cause, because I think that Senator Jackson did not allay the Chinese fear, since he himself perceived that of the administration.
Yeah, I think that's true. Because in effect, he was saying to them, that should have happened yesterday.
That's right. That's right. Let me suggest another factor over this summer of 79 from March on, and that's why I was touching earlier on the Deng Xiaoping-Hua Guofeng relationship. My impression was that Deng Xiaoping, in the months of April and May, had to give ground a little bit.
Deng did.
And that it was only on the eve of the Mondale visit that his own domestic situation turned for the better. You may remember on that very sensitive matter that came up during the visit, during the first session with Mondale, Deng said that we would have given you an answer earlier, but we had some problems on our side. Now they are resolved.
Right.
I've always been intrigued by those three sentences.
I would think it probably was concerning his stepping down as premier.
Deng stepping down?
No.
Hua stepping down. The Deng trying to get him to step down
and
couldn't get it. That's right. That was the issue.
Because Mondale did not meet with Hua Guofeng.
Oh, yes.
Did he?
Oh, yes. Certainly he did. He was the only American that I know who saw Hua and Deng shake hands. It was at the signing ceremony. Remember, he had a session with Hua, and then there was the signing ceremony, which both Hua and Deng attended.
Guofeng and Deng Xiaoping didn't even look each other in the eye. I remember saying to one of them, well, since they were both standing up, it would be very difficult for Deng to look him in the eye.
Looking at him at the navel.
But going back to the first full day of the visit on Monday the 27th, after the very successful meeting with Deng, went back to the guest house, and then the vice president was getting ready to go to Beida to make that speech. That was certainly a historic event. In connection with that speech, before the vice president arrived, I said, I think it was to Han Xu, or possibly Jiang Wenjin, that I'm sorry I don't yet have the text of the vice president's speech, but I will have it tomorrow, whenever. And his response was, we don't have to see that speech before he makes it. we don't need to know what he will say. But we did, of course, afford them an advanced text. But they made the commitment to air it on their TV and their radio without having seen mm-hmm. without having seen the text,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
which I thought was certainly an evidence of good faith. It was a great speech. It was a little unfortunate reference to Theodore Roosevelt towards the end, but otherwise.
Well, I put that in there.
Did you?
Yes, and I did not think it was unfortunate.
Really?
Absolutely not. As far as China policy is concerned, Theodore Roosevelt had a view of China that was not unlike what the subsequent, what this administration, I mean, it may cause you nervousness, but it is the right historical reference. And
I don't question that.
But
it was a little bit of a shock to that audience.
Oh, was it?
The immediate audience. I could tell by the
you think shocked because they didn't see the point, or that they didn't have a favorable image of Theodore Roosevelt?
I think Roosevelt and American imperialism were interchangeable. Theodore Roosevelt and American imperialism were interchangeable in their mind.
I
may be wrong on that.
You know, well, I'll tell you, the problem I had with that part, you know, I had something to do with that part of it. What president would you quote from to a Chinese audience? You can't do Woodrow Wilson, right?
No, that's true.
Worse. Then you might as well forget the intervening three. Franklin Delano Roosevelt? I don't know. I mean, you can go back and look at some stuff, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt ended up from 31 to 37 just watching, the 33 to 30 to 40, watching the Japanese take Manchuria and not acting as staunchly as Hoover did. And then you're stuck from Truman on. So there's not a single president that you could comfortably go back and select.
Well, it was...
But no, I mean, I just want to give you the background of my own thinking on that. And then, if one looks at the history books, Theodore Roosevelt had a greater admiration for the Japanese than for the Chinese. But what he was adamant about was not letting the Soviets dominate Manchuria. Absolutely adamant in trying to prevent that. And he saw...
The Russians at that point.
Boy, the Russians at that
point. Czar,
the
Czar's force.
Yeah.
And, of course, his involvement in the ending of the Russo-Japanese War in 1905 had a more global view than
that's right.
But
I take your point about the imperialist image of Theodore Roosevelt. You might have picked Taft. He may be, as I think about it, may have been. But who is William Howard Taft?
Yes, that's true.
But Roosevelt, both Roosevelt and William Howard Taft, what they had in common, and which is absent except for Franklin Delano Roosevelt, is the notion that a strong and modernizing China would be in America's interest. And those are the only three presidents who were willing to do something. That is to say, Theodore, Franklin Delano Roosevelt's, and Taft.
I see.
Are the only other three presidents that had the Carter, that Carter instinct.
Well, I'm glad I made the reference. A little education. but that was a great speech. And many Chinese afterwards who were not in that audience, but they played it on their television more than once. And I remember played it at 10 o'clock at night, I think, on that first day, which is an unusually late hour for the Chinese, for anything, but certainly for television. More than one Chinese told me how they had stayed up to listen to the vice president. And it was run uncut with the English and the translation.
Did any Chinese ever interpret for you what he or she thought the phrase meant? Any nation which seeks to isolate or weaken China in world affairs acts contrary to American interests. Did you ever have any talk about the
conversations I had, they just took it for granted that was our way of saying, you have any trouble with the polar bear, you have a buddy.
Oh, is that right? Because that's another sense I had hoped would be interpreted in China in a somewhat different way. Namely, but no one has ever picked it up, so that that part of an effort to communicate failed. Although the vice president understood what he was saying, because I'd gone over all this with him. One could never publicly indicate that we recognize the policies we pursued toward China harmed us, right? I mean, you could never say that. But if you ask yourself, what nation sought to isolate and weaken China in world affairs? It was not only the Soviet Union, but it was the United States from 1950 to 1971 or 72. And I think Vice President Mondale felt that in some way he should convey to a Chinese audience an awareness that our policies toward China in a previous era had not been, not only was it were they harmful to China, but they were not in our own national interest. But I think that's so elliptical it got lost.
No Chinese ever made that point, and to me with reference to, mm-hmm. to that part of the speech.
Because mm-hmm. certainly as I saw, the summary, what I saw of that speech and why I'm pleased to be associated with it was that it was an effort say that American foreign policy toward China had returned to its traditional moorings. And that's why the reference to Roosevelt, saying if there has been a historical continuity to American foreign policy, then we must see the era of Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson as an aberration. That the historic policy of the United States toward China has been that a unified China, modernizing China, is in our interest. And even Theodore Roosevelt had that view.
I see.
That, and then that phrase also fits in that theme. But I do think in retrospect that part of the effort to communicate didn't come across.
I don't think so. But that was a wonderful event, and Fritz Mondale certainly loved it, and he played it exactly right, mm-hmm. exactly right.
You know how many drafts that speech went through?
No.
16. He had an excellent speech writer, and we worked together through the first five drafts. Totally tearing the thing up, and then came back in at about the sixth draft. The idea for the speech itself goes to David Aaron. We sent our first planning memo for the Mondale trip, took place in July, soon after I got back from this vacation that I went on, and that was the, you remember I mentioned the trade thing didn't move
right.
forward, so I had two things on my agenda when I got back, was the Mondale trip and to get the trade thing back on track. And I sent a memo across the street of thoughts for Mondale, and Dave Aaron is a rather different person to work with than Brzezinski. Brzezinski does not cuss or get excited, but Dave Aaron gets awfully
yes.
excited. Oh, I got all excited. He said, "This is shit. Take this back." And I said, "Well, what I thought is good. It deals with all of the substance." He says, "Yeah." He says, "This is something Cy Vance could do. You're dealing with the Vice President of the United States, the number two man who gives me all this, the greatest man in the world, all of this." And I said, "What do you have in mind?" He says, "He's a political figure. This is a political event." He's right. I mean, he really had the insight that this is a political event. He is a political figure. This is not a diplomatic trip. And you haven't been associated with anything like this to date. This is a major event. You go back and think about things that he can do that make it political, not diplomatic. And so I said, "Well, I'll tell you one thing that I've always thought would be fabulous is if he could," and he said, "and get him out, meet people. He's a politician. He wants to go out and meet people. He doesn't want to stay in the Great Hall of the People all the time." So I came back with the idea of speech, and which is obvious. I mean, it didn't take you 3 minutes. Anyone can come up with the idea. We thought of a couple locales, but I thought Peking University was the obvious location. It was Peking University, but without saying anything, it was Harvard Yenching campus. So the symbolism was there.
Right.
The reaching out to the intellectuals we wanted. And then we had a couple other political things we tried to work out into the trip. But David really was the one who said, "You got to think of something." That the other things we thought were talk show on TV, a live press conference with Chinese journalists, or...
they wouldn't have known how to handle
or to ask us, or ask him to address either the CPPCC or the NPC or some delegation of Chinese political. We decided to go for the Peking University setting, and then that would give a historical kind of context to it.
Well, it couldn't have been better.
Yeah.
And then that the cultural performance that night at the small theater of the Great Hall was also very
you,
nice.
You want to know more about, did I tell you already about the Dick Holbrooke's role in that speech? I put that on the tape earlier. It's another one of those incidents of why I have some of the ambivalent feelings toward him, I do. The speech was drafted over at our side in the White House, but I wanted Dick to be fully involved, and I kept sending him each of the drafts. Chas Friedman had an input into the drafts after about five or six, but we kept sending them over to Dick, and I said, "Dick, look, the speech is going." He says, "I'll look at it on the plane." And I said, "Yeah, but the president will sign on it, because the president will want to see it. Before we get on the plane, please look at it, because only minor tinkering can be done after we leave, and the vice president wants to have it all done." So I sent over drafts, nothing. Finally, we get on the plane, looks over it, fine with me, you know, a couple changes here or there, but just stylistic, and they were improvements. And then when we got there, when the speech was finally delivered, he ran away totally from those sentences because Vance was very upset by several of the sentences in the speech. And the State Department, through Holbrooke, said that they had nothing to do with the speech and it hadn't been cleared through them. It was just really...
I didn't know that.
Just, and he didn't identify with it for bureaucratic purposes.
Hmm.
But that is a style that Chaz liked it, because Chaz had gotten involved in all of the drafts.
Yeah, he's a good man.
That's right.
Chaz Freeman.
That's right. That's right.
Excellent. And the next day we went back for the additional session with Deng Xiaoping. And as I remember it, that was more a wrap-up session.
World affairs. That was dealt with. No, that was a
whole... Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right.
The second session dealt with Vietnam, Cambodia. Mondale made his presentation, I think, began to broach the Cambodia issue the first time, and then they came back to it the second day. Also, intensely fought over issue. I think you were involved in the wording on that side. I don't remember on his Mondale's talking points on Cambodia.
Yeah.
And that was fought to the very last minute.
That tied in with the luncheon the vice president had with Wang Hua, and then Wang Hua asked to see him in a smaller group after the luncheon. That's when he went very earnestly into the business of the Khmer Rouge and Cambodia, and how they were going to be different, and they really should be supported because it was the only game in town as far as opposition to the Vietnamese concerned, and they were going to make certain, I forget just what changes, but they were obviously purely cosmetic. But he was so earnest and so serious. He obviously put a great, great store upon this presentation.
They also, at this time, shared with us their best estimates of the military situation in Vietnam, Cambodia. Was the best intelligence we had received from the Chinese to that point.
Right.
You got that was to David Aaron and myself from the head of their military intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think we shared that with you as a map as to where each Vietnamese division was deployed.
Over-optimism about the development of events, I think, clearly showed at that time and still shows. And the belief that they seem to have that the Vietnamese economy really can buckle under the pressure of events. Not the first time they said to us 2 to 5 years, or had they said that before?
No. Mm-hmm. No, but although I took the 2 to 5 years to be a retreat, that they had been more optimistic about bringing the Vietnamese to heel.
I see.
And I think it began to show that the realization that they were in for a protracted period. I put the focus more on the 5 years than the two, saying this is going to be a very long, drawn-out affair. Of course, the other issue, and just going over the issue of the moment, which always makes one of these trips not what one planned, was the Mondale's task of securing a Chinese vote in the UN for imposition of sanctions against Iran for the seizure of our prisoners. Remember that? That's the issue that came out of left field. It's one of the problems with a trip-driven diplomacy, that the issue of the moment always assumes greater significance than all the plans that you lay for the months in advance. And for this one, he was trying to nail down their UN vote. Do you remember that?
The UN vote for what?
Sanctions against the Vietnamese. Sanctions against the Iranians in the UN. Our prisoners had been taken hostage, right?
No, not that quick.
No?
That was...
When did the prisoners get taken hostage? Was it the Brown? I have the wrong visit.
Yes, because I stayed behind. And the Brown visit will come to that.
Oh, that's the Brown.
I stayed behind in Peking to get the Chinese answer.
When did the prisoners get taken hostage?
It was later that year. Later that year. 144 days. Was it, how many days was it?
It was over a year.
300 and some days, wasn't it? How much over a year?
I don't remember. That's something we can check on.
See, January 81. It took place in December, I think. November, December of 80, of 79.
You're right. You're right. Too early. My memory's bad.
Certainly been excellent so far. Now, the signing ceremony, was that before the return banquet?
Yes, to the best of my recollection.
Because I know it on the day of departure for Xi'an, Wednesday the 29th, I had a meeting with the section chiefs and shown nothing at all on that morning.